Thank you. Thank you. All right. Good evening, everyone. My name is Maren Harwood, grateful recovered alcoholic. Good to be asked back yet again. I appreciate this. I appreciate this group a lot. And the readings in the beginning. I was talking before the meeting started, and today I had an opportunity to do some stuff at home. I work a lot, so when I have time at home, I like to get some stuff done around the house. So literally around the house. Today I got outside with the mower, right? I did the edging, and I mowed the lawn. I played with the kids, and it reminded me of one of my favorite analogies that I use, especially with new people, but even more so with people that have been around a while. And it directly relates to what we're going to talk about tonight in step 10. So I use the analogy that, like, an individual blade of grass, right? Individual blade of grass, you know, amongst a group is pretty powerful, right? But each one, right, has one goal. One goal and one goal only. And that's to grow to the sun, right? That's its goal, right? That's the idea. That's their one kind of mission, is grow to their, what? Higher power, right? That's the idea. So when I get out there, right, I'll get my, you know, lawnmower gassed up and ready to go, smiling, pushing this lawnmower, and then all of a sudden life on life's terms hits for this blade of grass and gets chopped right down to here, probably, right? Right. So the blade of grass has really no other option but to continue to do what it was doing before. It was grow to the sun, right? Same thing with us in AA, right? So, you know, we get this solution and we stumble across possibly this higher power and maybe some of these 10-step promises that we're reading are going to come true in our lives, and it's just absolutely incredible, and we feel the flow of God and the spirit of the group with us, and we want nothing more than be helpful and useful, and then bam, life on life's term happens, right? The cosmic lawnmower comes straight across our life, right, and whittles us right down. We've got two options, right? What do we do, right? And the directions in the book explicitly say, right, what we're about to read in the 10th step. It's going to tell us exactly what to do. There are four disciplines of the 10th step. We'll go over them tonight. And it tells me exactly what to do when life on life's terms hits me. Explicit and exact directions, or the book calls it clear-cut directions, on exactly what to do when life on life's terms hits, right? So when that happens, right, unfortunately for somebody like me, I like to, you know, complain about it. I like to sit in it. I like to be a victim. I like to point fingers, right? That's my typical go-to, right? But then there's no growth there, right? As you may or may not know, there's no growth in that. Unfortunately, when I aim the mirror outward at other people, there's no growth for somebody like me. I need to aim that mirror inward, right? And then I could see where it is that I fell short. Where's my reaction to certain things? What is the part of, and what we went over in inventory a couple weeks ago, right? What part of my makeup is holding me back from getting closer to my connection with God? That's the end of it. Or if you want to call it just feeling free or feeling light or whatever, however, call it whatever you want, right? But it's really the nearness to our, as the book calls it, creator, right, is really what we're after. So we're going to have a series through life of getting connected and then getting disconnected. Getting connected, getting disconnected, over and over and over again. And that's the whole point. That's why it tells us in the analogy that we have a simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. Right? That's what it tells me. So then I have an opportunity when the time comes to select the appropriate tool for the job, utilize what was put in front of me, then put it back in the toolbox in case it's needed again. Right? That's the idea. And then let other people know, hey, by the way, I may or may not have gone through something like this, very similar. I know it feels the same. Here, this is the tool that I used. You're certainly welcome to use it. I'm going to lay it at your feet for you, right? I can't fix it for you, right? But I can lay it at your feet for you. And if you have an opportunity to use it, please, by all means, go for it. So when we get to step 10, right, we read the beautiful promises in the 9th step, right? Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. That is the most beautiful promises in the 9th step promises. Right, the last sentence, they will always materialize. Use the word always. Right? That's a promise. They will always materialize if, here's the caveat, right? We work for them. Right? So he's talking about in this chapter lots of action, work, demonstration. Those are the words that he's using throughout. This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory. We're in the middle of 84. Continue to take personal inventory and set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So, the book tells me when I'm supposed to do step 10 while I'm doing step 9. Right? Let's read that again. We vigorously commence this way of living, right, setting right any new mistakes as we go along, as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit, capitalized S, implies God and Spirit in this scenario, right? Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. So it's telling me, literally, this is my next function, grow, right? Again, an analogy, right? We could use the blade of grass analogy, right? To grow in understanding and effectiveness, right? So understanding is again up in here, and then effectiveness is what we can do with our head-heart connection, which is what we've built through this point. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God to remove them. Not if these crop up, when these crop up. Very specific. And we just read the first discipline of the 10th step. Right, it's a prayer, and we ask God at once to remove them. Not only is he telling us what to do, he's telling us when to do it. Right, so when any of these, right, let's go through this. So, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, when these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them right then and there. Right, sometimes if it's strong enough, we might not be able to go through the rest of the day and then ask God before we go to bed to remove it. We might need it gone right away. Depends on the severity. Especially if I'm noticing it in the moment, that's when I know it's bad. Like the ones that I don't notice, I can kind of just skirt through, and then I can clean those up. You know, after, if it falls through the colander, I can clean that up in step 11, as I might catch it later on a review. But this is as we go along, and we see these things, bam, like, God, remove these. There's discipline number one of the 10th step. Right? Discipline number two is we discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Now, let's take a historical context into this. Did Bill pull out his iPhone and call Ebby when something went down? No. Bill, this was written between 1937 and 1939. Bill, as far as immediate communication, what does that mean? What did that mean for somebody like him? That meant that the people around him in his life knew what he was doing, knew what he was after, knew what he was about, right? It's funny how we talk about anonymity, right? A lot of people, and I get that, and there's a lot of instances where anonymity makes sense. The 12 traditions tell me that I got to be anonymous at the level of press, radio, and films. Right? That's where we need to protect AA as a whole, is that we're anonymous there. Right? When it comes to anonymity in general, this is literally saying there should be people around me to some degree that know what I'm after, know what I'm striving for, know that I'm not drinking anymore, know that I'm trying to better and change my life and the people around me. Right? So that means that without the use of a cell phone, really without the use of direct communication, across a distance, Bill and the people who wrote this book had to have people in their lives that they could discuss this stuff with. They didn't have meetings 24/7. They didn't have roundups. They didn't have, it wasn't like that, right? So maybe it was a fellow employee. Maybe it was their spouse. Maybe it was their friend. Maybe somebody that they were around. Who knows? But the point would be, let's consider when this book was written, he wasn't able to just call up his sponsor on a moment's notice. He wasn't able to just call Dr. Bob when he needed to. He literally needed to have people in his life that where he'd be able to tell something like this to, right? That would be able to understand what he's striving after. So what is it exactly that he says, discuss them with someone immediately. Not discuss necessarily what they did, but discuss the selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Right? Nothing is more outside of my strike zone than talking about somebody. It's with somebody that I'm afraid of something. Right? It's just not easy for someone like me to do that because I have to come across as a certain something. My stage character will not allow me to do that. The stage character I play at work will not allow me to tell you I don't know something. My stage character at the house will not allow me to say that I don't know how to do something. It's just the way, and maybe other people aren't built this way, but I know that I am. Like, it's hard for me to admit wrongdoing. But it turns out that I have to, right, in order to continue to maintain the spiritual way of life that is put in front of me, that God gifted me the day that he, she, or it decided that day was going to be the last day I had a drink or a drug. Right? Because it wasn't me that decided that. I'll have you all know. Like, I've decided that a bunch of times in the past, and then all of a sudden, every time I relapse, when I do it sober, my sober brain says, hey, you know what, that's probably, alcohol is probably a good idea. Like, let's roll with that, right? So, This higher power, you know, God, call it whatever you want, right? I have to understand, for me personally, the day, like, my sobriety date is not mine. It was the day that God saw fit to remove that obsession just long enough for, and just enough cracks in the dome so the light can get in, and an ability to understand what it is that I'm really up against. That's really what this boils down to. So having someone, and then, so these are two more. So these are two and three, right? Talk, discuss it with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we had harmed anyone. Then the fourth discipline of the 10th step. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Right? There's the fourth discipline. Resolutely, fully, totally, right? You fill in whatever word you want. Turn, pivot, move, right? Meaning our thoughts are somewhere else. They need to go to this place, right? Pivot, move our thoughts to someone we can help. This is a butchered sentence in AA, right? A lot of people will say, love and tolerance is our code. Whoa, pause. That's not what the book says. The book says, love and tolerance of others is our code, right? Loving and tolerating others, meaning the people that we're going to resolutely turn our thoughts to help. That's what that sentence means, right? There's people out there that are sick and suffering at the moment, right? That could use a bit of hope. Why do we use this in the fourth discipline of the 10th step? So I stop thinking about me. That's what I'm thinking about when I'm selfish, dishonest, resentful, and fearful. I'm thinking about me the whole time. That's it. That's why. So if we can resolutely turn my thoughts to somebody that I can help, I'm not thinking about me anymore, right? That's the driving force. If I can stop thinking about me, I'm going to be okay, right? Turns out that's the trick to this whole thing. If I call it a trick, but like that's the whole deal. If I stop thinking about me, I can think about somebody else. And if I'm thinking about somebody else, I'm going to have a hard time thinking about me, right? So that's why we, and again, it's in this order too, right? It's in this order for a reason. So those are the four disciplines of the 10th step. After those four disciplines of the 10th step, some of the most beautiful promises in the big book we're about to get hit with. As far as promises go, these are literally talking about, right, how we can get well, how we can recover in AA. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. That sounds a lot like the second step. Right, tells me in the second step that I'm going to be restored to sanity, right? And that happens on the back end in the 10th step. Also, it turns out later on, I'm just going to, I don't want to ruin the end of the story for you, but we get our will back in the 10th step too. But we don't get it back in the way that we used it before. We have an explicit and exact way to use our will. Right, but this promise that our sanity will have returned is beautiful. It was teed up for me in the second step. I just had to do the work in between to get to that point. That's all, right? That's it. So just a little bit of step work, right? For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes! ! That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. That's very similar to the word care in the third step. Right? So if we talk about the word care, right, we're placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Right, where the third step tells me if I make that decision, right, over to the care of God, right. So this is there's some the care, and then through a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor we are afraid. This is our experience, right? So he's throwing that little caveat in there. This is their experience here at this point. That is how we react. Here's the kicker. So long as we keep in fit spiritual condition, what does that look like? Right? That looks like something a little bit different for every person, but he's going to give us exact directions on what to do. He's also going to tell us what it's going to look like if we don't do it. Right? That's one of the best parts about the way Bill writes. He likes to give you a little bit of, hey, well, you know, you could do this, or you could do this. This is what we found that's working. Go ahead, your choice. These are just suggestions, by the way. Right? That's kind of the way he puts it. Right? So as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition, right? The easy kind of direct correlation to this is like fit physical condition. Right? What does that look like? Going to the gym once a week and eating whatever we want? Turns out that's not the case. Right? Turns out there's a few other things that are involved in that, right? Maybe it's a little bit more discipline when it comes to, you know, going to the gym or what we're eating, or even just getting out and movement and walking, whatever that looks like, right? So keeping in fit spiritual condition, what does that also imply? That also implies that we're automatically there in spiritual condition. We are placed in this position. We are already there. It tells me automatically this stuff's going to be happening, right? I'm placed there. It's like I can place this over here, right? Unbeknownst to the bottle, I was placed there, right, in that position of neutrality, right? So it tells me that I have to keep in fit spiritual condition, implying that I'm already kind of in it. I need to maintain that. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. It's just, and now it's giving me, there's a little bit of a warning here. Hey, by the way, it's kind of easy to like hit the brake right now, because you're feeling pretty good. Things are, especially if these promises are coming true, it's like the afterburners are put on. Like everything is just, we're smooth sailing. Everything is good, right? Internally, spiritually, whatever you want to call it, you know, at that time. But it's telling me it's easy to let up on the program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. Right, so foe meaning it's opposite in character. Right, a foe is like an enemy or like someone who's an opposite in character to you. So again, it's kind of lining up with this whole spirit versus spirit idea. Right, so if I maintain a fit spiritual condition, there is no room for the spirit of alcohol. Right, but if I let up on this spiritual program of action, it turns out that the other spirit tends to gain ground. And then once the spirit is done, then all of a sudden I'm going to... So what is that also implying? That also implies that the human is constantly seeking a spiritual solution to our problems. Whether that be alcohol or whether that be the other spirit. Same thing, I heard this a long time ago and I love this. Like the person that's sitting at the bar stool is looking for the same thing that someone is sitting at the church pew. They're both looking for the same thing. Right, the spirit to make them feel better, whatever that might be. Right, so that's again, it's easy for us to let up on that. Alcohol is a subtle foe, someone who, again, right, who is different than us in character. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Right, so again, not cured of alcoholism. Right. The difference between alcohol and alcoholism are three letters, ISM. The alcoholism, right, is an internal spiritual malady. If you think of the ISM, the difference, if you want to label it that way. So I have an internal spiritual malady. So I'm not cured of that. So someone who suffers from alcoholism doesn't suffer from alcoholism when they're drinking. Because alcohol cures alcoholism. right? Alcohol fixes alcoholism. I might still have the characteristics of it, but when the alcoholism I really suffer from is when I'm sober. Right? That's when I really truly quote unquote suffer. Meaning I don't have a solution to my answer. Alcohol has been taken away from me. Maybe I'm locked up, maybe I'm institutionalized, whatever it is, right? Or just sitting detoxing on mom's couch, right? Whatever, like that's been taken away from me. The medicine cabinet's cleaned out and whatever, like I'm there, like, but I'm suffering from alcoholism because I don't have a treatment for that. Until there's a treatment for the alcoholism. So it's telling me we're not cured of it, right? Because I'm going to have a sober mind. I still have, again, the capacity for my brain to say alcohol is a good idea, right? Because again, that's when we relapse. Like it's said kind of tongue in cheek, but the idea that what's the number one cause of relapse? Sobriety. Right? It's funny in a way because it's like, well, yeah, the only way you can relapse is when you're sober, like, duh. But really, ultimately, it is. Right? People might drink for different reasons or different variations or what? Who knows? Like, whatever that might be, good, bad, or indifferent. But the sober mind decides. Right? Just like again, in the third step, we're making a decision, right? The sober mind decides and then the action is taken. So my mind can decide to do something and then not take any action. So again, a decision without action is fantasy. But the idea that we're not cured of alcoholism only because I still have a mind that seeks relief. One way or another, I will get it. Whether that comes from alcohol, whether that comes from God, or anywhere in between. Right? They call it comfort food for a reason, right? It might be food, whatever it might be. Like, you fill in your ism. It doesn't necessarily matter. Like the doctor's opinion said, I'm restless, irritable, discontented, which is kind of the definition of alcoholism, right? Until I can feel the effects of ease and comfort that come at once by taking a couple drinks. That's what I'm after, ease and comfort. So I'm not cured of looking for ease and comfort. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. Boy, bring that up at your next open discussion meeting and see how that goes. Hey, I read the sentence in the big book. Let's talk about gratitude. Let's talk about humility. Like, oh, I actually read the sentence in the big book. Every day is a day we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. We should discuss that and see how. And again, what's going to happen is a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, not in their minds maybe, like, not all of my activities. I mean, when I'm, you know, helping somebody, no problem. But, I don't need to do God's will, in the bedroom. Right? Or I don't need to do God's will, at work. I can handle that, those two things. It's funny. Those are the things that the alcoholic seems to think that we have a grasp on when we really have no grasp on it at all. Right? Finance and romance. Those are the things that we try to control. Right? And then when they get out of control, I need ease and comfort. Typically. Doesn't mean it's 100%, but again, the old analogy, like, oh, a broken shoelace, I want to drink. It's like, no, you already have an alcoholic mind. You're going to drink no matter what. You just made up that excuse with the broken shoelace, right? If you still have an alcoholic mind, more than likely you're going to drink again. And I hate to be so crass, except that's just the case. I know it from personal experience, right? Without a sufficient change in mindset, alcohol is still going to be an option. Right, and so as long as alcohol is still an option, I still have an alcoholic mind. So without God's help to change, right, the alcoholic mind, I'm not going to have very much of a shot. Now, here's a 10-step prayer. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. Like, not just once a day when you read the daily reflections in the morning and that's it. Thoughts that must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. Bingo! Sanity is returning and I have a proper use of the will. What's the will? How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine. Notice how it throws that in there, right? Thy will, not mine, be done. Right? That's the proper use of the will. We can utilize this all we want. Right? Provided we're doing it in a really sincere way. It's like, I don't know, I'm kind of stuck and locked in indecision. right? What's God's will for me in this? As opposed to, I'm just going to wing this and figure this out on my own, right? Which could turn out okay. It could not turn out okay. I don't, again, like we do get to be, turns out, human, right? So we are going to, as some people call it, take our will back. I don't see it that way. It's the way the book just put it. I see it using it wrong, right? We're not necessarily taking it back because we have the proper use of the will. We already have it. So I'm not taking it back. All I'm doing is just aiming it in the wrong direction, or I'm utilizing it improperly. So taking my will back implies like that it's somewhere else. That's not what it just told me, right? I can exercise my willpower along this line all we wish, meaning I still have use of it. I have a choice on which way to utilize the will. I'm not just scooping it back. I'm just placing it in the wrong spot or aiming it in the wrong direction, whatever it might be. So that's proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength and inspiration and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God conscious. So here, let's utilize kind of what it's telling me here. If we carefully follow directions up to this point, right, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us, right? So again, it's flowing to us, right? Typically in this region. And then it says, to some extent, we have become God conscious. This region, my mind, right? So it's telling me that up to this point, if I've carefully followed directions, there is the head-heart connection is happening. The flow is happening. That's why we write the inventory, because there's blockages blocking us from connecting the head and the heart. We've been running on sheer reason and sheer will, our own will, using the noodle. Right, and then now we've created this connection. It literally just told me, to some extent, we have become God conscious. Again, we begin to develop this vital sixth sense. Vital means life giving. So without it, we might not survive this thing. We might not. All these beautiful promises, and then at the end, it just drops that in there. This is a vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action. Man, action and more action. I got to do more stuff, more things, right? It's like I just got done mowing the lawn, and it's like, oh, yeah, you got to like mow the neighbor's lawn too, turns out. Like, oh, I got to do that too? Yeah, more action. We have plenty of time, so we're going to jump into step 11 tonight too. So we have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy in this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. There you go, right? Let's talk about that for a second. It works, again, the caveat, if we have a proper attitude and work at it. That's really it. It's really all that you need. Does it have to be specific and exact? Does it have to be a religious prayer? No. I've got to practice it, right? I've got to have a proper attitude, right? And work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. The biggest word in there is the word constructive. Construct means to build, right? We're not destructively reviewing our day. It's not all red letters. It's not all negative. We're doing this to construct something. We're doing this to build something. Throughout the book, he talks about talking like building an archway that we walk to freedom. There's a lot of building analogies. There's a keystone he talks about, right, which is the middle part, all right, of this. He uses the word touchstone, which is the cornerstone. If you go to any large old buildings or churches where it has chiseled out the date that the building was constructed, that's called a touchstone. It's cornerstone. So that they put that there, right? This is when the building was built. So we're talking about constructively reviewing our day. It'd be very easy to sit and be like, just beat myself up at night. Be like, this is what I did wrong. This is how bad I was. I should have done this. I could have done that. Right? But that's not what it's asking me to do. We might dive into that, but it's gonna warn me what happens if we, as he's calling it, drift in a little bit when we get to there. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? That's a direct question. Right? Were we selfish? Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Again, you're asking yourself these questions. It's not saying to write it down. Again, I'm a big book thumper. If you want to write that down, go for it. But the book's not telling me to. It's literally telling me to ask myself this. Do we owe an apology? It's yes or no. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? That's a yes or no. Were we kind and loving toward all? Yes or no. And the next is we kind of opens it up. What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Again, that's a yes or no question. Most of the time, I like to think of it as the pie chart of my day, right? Or the pie chart of my thoughts. Like, on the pie chart, what percentage am I thinking about me? Right? That's the way I look at it. Just built, you know, I'm built a little, it just makes it easier for me. Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking ourselves most of the day? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? See, that's the aim. There's our pie chart. Two colors, right? Call it whatever colors you want. Let's be contrasting from the color wheel. Orange and blue, all right? Blue is the stream of life. Orange is the other stuff. Right? What on my pie chart here, like, what was the percentage that I was trying to be helpful and useful to other people, and right, and trying to pack things into the stream of life in a positive way, right? And what stuff is in the orange, right? That's kind of the way it's literally giving us the two factors. There's not like seven different colors on this pie chart, it turns out, just those two. But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. Right? Again, this is, we're constructively reviewing our day. If we're building something, right, we can't drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. Right? And the word worry, it always, every time I hear that word, every time I read that word, it always makes me think of what Ralph Waldo Emerson said about worry. He said, worry is the misuse of imagination. Right? So when I'm worrying about something, I'm imagining something bad about something that hasn't happened, might happen, could happen, or just in general, not whatever it might be. Right? That's my worry. Right? But that's my imagination in a negative vibe. As opposed to not worrying, but using my imagination and putting it on the other side of things and making it be positive, right? Am I going to do that 100% of the time? No, I've got little kids that like to jump off of very high things. That's worrying to me. All right? Are there instances where worry makes sense? Yes, right? Right? Am I worrying about what other people might be thinking about me? Is that a good use of my worry? No. Right, because I have no control over that. Right, and so maybe it's kind of picking and choosing. The human brain was built to like worry for a very specific reason. It's called survival. Right, like when we let's say we were emerging from our cave and we were coming out and we were looking at. Do you think that like the cave folk when they came out were like looking at the horizon? We're like, oh my goodness. What a beautiful day. Like, look at the sun's rising. The birds are chirping. No. They wake up worried. Is there something that's going to kill me when I look out here today? Like, it's built, like, it's part of our brain. Like, we're literally built, like, to first from the rip when we wake up in the morning. And that's what it's going to tell us when we got to direct our thinking most is when we wake up in the morning, right? That's first when we go to bed at night, so we have a better shot when we wake up in the morning, right, at having a clearer thought conscious. But again, I have to watch out for drifting. Notice how it doesn't say like just going to it. Like drifting into it is like this slow kind of slide into worry, right? Remorse or morbid reflection. And what does that diminish? My usefulness to what? To others. After making our review, here comes a prayer because it says we ask. We ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. God, forgive me for what I did or didn't do today. What should I do next time? Done. Right? Again, and you can do this however you like. If you want to write it down, if you want to put it in a Google Doc, I don't care. If you want to put it on YouTube, whatever. But the idea is to be doing this when we retire at night, right? And there's a few different schools of thought behind this, right? A few different varying opinions on why he would put the night review before the morning review. Because the logical mind would say, I need to know what to do in the morning first. Well, the idea, if we're rapidly progressing through step work and we're actually into action, more than likely we're going to be starting and working on our 10th and 11th step right after or during while we're making amends, right after we had the list of people we had harmed and kind of where do we make that list in the inventory. So if we're toppling from one step into the next, it turns out we might be going to bed, right, and learning as we go, steps 10 and 11. So when we retire at night. So after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and, not or, and, right? I'm asking God to forgive me. And I'm also saying, hey, what corrective measures should be taken, right? How can I do better next time? I guess is really meaning when I wake up tomorrow. And here's exactly how. On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Now let's keep in mind, as we're doing this, we've been given the tool of proper use of the will. Our sanity is back, and we've been given the proper use of the will. So again, we have the right tools for the job here. Before we begin, here's what we ask as another prayer. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Let's break that sentence down a minute. So before we begin, we're praying to God to direct our thinking. Like, direct it. Move it from where it is and direct it somewhere else. It's probably not all that good starting off the rip. I heard an old-timer say this one time, and I loved it. It's like, I wake up in the morning, my brain's already getting a speeding ticket. Like, yeah, I get that, I get. I'm already, like, I spring up in the morning, if I spring up in the morning or whatever. My first, when I open my eyes, my brain's already figured out something to be worried about, something that's not good enough, something that I got to do that I don't want to do. Like, I'm already there. Like it's like right before I open my eyes, it's like, okay, go, action. Think about yourself, go. Right, that's literally how my brain works. So once we do that, first we got to ask God, right, to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Now, the word divorce is an interesting one here, right? So divorce means to what? Separate. Right, if two people that are married get a divorce, those people, like, they don't cease to exist. They still exist. They're just separated. Right, so I'm asking God, right, to direct my thinking and divorce it from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. I'm not asking God to remove those because they're always going to be there. That's kind of a tall ask. I'm just asking that right here, right now, while I'm planning the day, just separate my thinking from those. If it's God's will, of course. Under these conditions, right, meaning if they're divorced, right, if they're separated out, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. Again, another butchered sentence in the big book. Well, God gave me a brain to use, so I decided to, I don't know, run around and sleep with everyone under the sun. It's like, whoa, that's not. Oh, I'm just an alcoholic thinking. Like, whoa. That's not what that sentence says at all. Right? God gave us brains to use because at this point he's given us the proper direction and guidance on how to use it. Not that you could just go run around and do whatever your brain tells you to do, because that's not good. It turns out that's not good. Right? So if we can direct it, right, we ask God, under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. Right, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane, that's a promise, when, here's the caveat, our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. Interesting concept. Whenever I read this sentence, it makes me think of, you guys remember that toy Etch-a-Sketch? like the little red thing, and you had the knobs on it, and you could draw, like, and then you draw it, right? And then when you want to clear it, what do? Shake it, right? So literally, if we're going to take this literally, we're asking God to clear our wrong motives. Meaning, I clear the Etch-A-Sketch, and then what do? Hand it over. Right? That's the idea. Okay, God, here, my Etch-A-Sketch is cleaned up. Good looking out, thank you. Here, take this from me, because I'm going to draw some terrible stuff on there. Right? I'm not going to do well with this, because I have, let's look at the record. Right? Here, take this from me. That's kind of the idea. We're cleared of wrong motives, right? And let's let God handle the thinking and thought processes moving forward. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here, we ask, again, a prayer for inspiration, an intuitive thought, or a decision. We relax and take it easy. Now, again, that's another. Oh, don't worry, just relax and take it easy. I know you just got out of detox and you're thinking about a drink, but just relax and take it easy. It's like, whoa, that's not what... No. Taking it out of context. The context is when we're thinking about our day and we face indecision, and then first we ask God for the intuitive thought. That's when we take it easy to make room for the answer. That's what we're asking for. That's what the book's telling me to do. That it's not telling me to relax and take it easy when my inventory is not done yet. It's not asking me to relax and take it easy when I know I need to make amends. It's not what it's telling me to do. It's telling me to relax here in this moment when I face indecision. If I face indecision in my day, we don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. There you go. There's your out, kind of. Like, is it going to work right away? No. What used to be a hunch or occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. So as we do it, as we practice it, it gets better. It gradually becomes, as it tells me, a working, functioning, useful part of the mind. Being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption, right? The presumption is what? That we're going to be God conscious all the time. That's the presumption that we're talking about, right? In all sorts of absurd actions and ideas, right? What do those look like? I don't know, gambling all your money on DraftKings sportsbook. I don't know, going to the casino when you know you probably shouldn't. I don't know, talking to an ex online, or who knows, eating gluttonously, lustful thoughts or actions, or who knows, you name it, right? But I'm still sober, right? But again, these all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. I think it's God-inspired that I go and spend my bonus check at Atlantic City. God is inspiring me right now to go put it all on black. What the hell? I don't think so, more than likely. But again, like, so if our thinking is cleared of wrong motives, if we're kind of aimed in the proper direction, but we have to understand we're not going to be inspired or quote-unquote connected at all times. We might pay for that assumption in all sorts of ideas, right? Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. Again, we're talking about the prayer at the end, but the word meditation is dropped in there. Right? So again, meditation. So what does that mean? What did it just tell us? We usually conclude the period of meditation. That means what we just did in thinking about our day, the 24 hours. We pause, right? And then we think, like, okay, what do we do? I'm asking God for inspiration, intuitive thought. Like, right when we wake up in the morning, what's it telling me I just did if I do what it tells me? I just meditated. Right? The idea of meditation is different for each person. Some people think you have to be sitting on the top of a mountain with the monks saying the Om position to meditate. Right? Other people can meditate while you're doing the dishes. It's like this. But the idea is, the way the book tells me to my kindergarten level, all right, let's call it what it is, my pre-K level of meditation is this. This is where we start. This is the beginning. So this period of meditation, I ask God, right? I pray that I be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, and that I be given whatever is needed right, to take care of such problems. Again, we ask is another prayer. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no request for ourselves only. Interesting piece and bit of information there, right? God, please let me get this job. Sounds like a pretty good prayer. Not bad, but I'm asking for myself only, right? God, please provide me the ability to provide for my family. Much different than, God, give me this job, right? Instead of, God, keep me sober today prayer, because I'm only asking for me, right? God, give me the ability to help others today. Big difference, right? God, help. God, let me think less of me so I can help you. There we go, right? And then, so it's like praying for ourselves only, it's going to tell us like exactly how that's going to work out. It ultimately doesn't. So our thought life has to be shifted. It has to be shifted from God, give me, to like, God, what can I give you? Right, there's an entire shift that has to happen, right? And a lot of this, and that's not a bad prayer. God, keep me sober today. Like, it's not a bad prayer. Like, I get that, right? But like, am I going to follow that up with actions in which the way that the book was designed to do to maintain that, or am I just going to ask for it and hope it happens, right? So there's some things that come along with it, right? God, help me be. Help me be less selfish and more useful today, right? What does that imply? Less of me, more to help others, right? So our prayer life has to have a little shift too, right? Here's my prayer life while I was in active addiction. God, please don't let him turn the cop turn the lights on behind me, right? God, I'll never drink again if you get me out of this, right? All super selfish prayers. And yet, when we get sober, we think like just asking for ourselves something is somehow less selfish. It's really not. What's the motive behind it? Okay, how about this? God, keep me sober today so I can be helpful to others. Bam! There we go. That works. Let's plug that little bit in on the end there, right? On the end of this prayer, right? But let's remember, like, we got to be careful to make no request for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful to never pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. Why? Because I'm reading this book right now. That's why. That's where selfish prayer gets me, right? Institutionalized, whatever, you're locked up. You know, again, I'm wrapped in the bondage of self, as it tells me in step 3. That's where my selfish prayers get me. If circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to that also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. Again, this is not telling you to go to church. Here's what it's telling you, is that there's books out there that might be able to aim your prayer life in a different way than what you think it should be. There, you can get suggestions from folks, right? There's people in the room that might have ideas about this sort of thing. Different books and different modalities, different ways. Taoism, Buddhism, yoga. I don't know. You name it. And there's other religious texts that I never... If you would have told me that I was going to read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis and have that book profoundly change my life, I would have yelled at you 9 years ago. I might have acted out in violence. That's where I was. That's where I was mentally. But I swear on everything, that book changed my life. Did it make me a certain religion? No. But did it change the way that I thought about things? For sure. 100%. You know what he said in that book? He said, humility is not thinking of thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. Like, oh, I get it. Right? Like, humility is really not thinking I'm less than anybody else. It's like, well, how can I think more of others? Right? That's true humility. Right, utilizing the time, which is the only commodity that I'll never get back that I can give, is my time. utilizing that to be helpful and useful to somebody else. It's a great correlation to what we're reading now. Right? So those kind of ideas, those types of things. Emmett Fox wrote some really good stuff that Bill was reading. Right? Sermon on the Mount. He used that to write this book. He used it to write the big book. He would go listen to Emmett Fox on Friday nights in New York when Bob was in town. Why would he do it when Bob was in town? Bill was not the most religious dude. Right? Bob was. But here's the correlation. Neither of them could stay sober until they found out the one commonality that's needed. A power greater than themselves and another alcoholic. Bingo. That was the magic of it all. Right? All of a sudden now, we figure something out. That the best way to get connected with a higher power is through somebody else. Turns out. Right? I know, it's funny. I just want to selfishly be able to pray myself sober all day long. I wish that was the case. It would be easier. I mean, way easier. Right? Oh, God, keep me sober today. Great, thanks. Got it. Now I just go do whatever I want. And then come back home and thank God for keeping me sober another day. Like, we might be able to get away with that for a little while. Some people have been getting away with that for years. Right? But what does that in-between look like? It was I was listening to this guy. I won't say his name because he's somewhat controversial. But he talked about on the headstone. Right? What's the most important thing? He's like, you go to a cemetery and you read these headstones. A lot of them are going to be very similar. It's going to say, beloved father, beloved mother, son, daughter. It's going to say a lot of the very similar language, right? What's the most important piece on the headstone? Is the dash in between the years. Like, what happened in between those years? Not the day we were born or the day we passed, but what did we do with that dash in the middle, right? That's the stuff. People remember us for those things, right? What did we do? What did we give? Who did we help? Right? Those little things, right? And it's profound if you really think about it, right? That's when my kids were watching the History Channel and it was like this silly show. It wasn't silly. It was a lot of good information, but it was like how Campbell's soup revolutionized the way they condensed the soup down into a smaller can so it could easily be shipped in the early 1900s. And it's like, that was revolutionary. That was big. But like, what did they really do, right, in that dash? They were able to feed an entire nation more sufficiently, right? If you really look at it, like, sure, they made a lot of money and whatever, and their Campbell's kids are still, you know, trust funds and all that good stuff. If you could look at it negatively, but ultimately, it's like, they did something with that dash, right? And there's good and there's bad, right? So there's what are we doing with that, like, as the book calls it, like, today? What's my daily reprieve look like? What's my connection with God look like? How am I helping others today? Because we stack those up and it looks pretty good after a while. And then it gradually, as it tells me, it promised me that it becomes a working part of the mind, right? And then we'll finish this up a little bit next week because we're right at the time. There's just a couple paragraphs left. And then what we'll do is we'll dive into working with others. The rest of the book is devoted to step 12, right? So the biggest chunk of the book is devoted to step 12, which is going to maintain and teach us how to help other folks, right? And different avenues by which we can do that. So, again, I appreciate the group. Thank you guys for having me. Questions, comments, concerns, nonviolent disagreements up next.